Hi, this is Imelda May, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to episode number 192 of your favorite doggone podcast, Walking the Floor. I gotta admit, I am lagging this week. It's Sunday, and I'm still recording and editing and mixing down an episode of my podcast that I gotta post, like, now to get up for you on Monday, because I'm trying to meet this once-a-week schedule, but honestly, I can't keep up. Can you keep up? Is this too much? Is this once-a-week podcast schedule too much content? Be honest with me. DM me, tweet at me, let me know. Are you able to keep up with it? Because I'm not able to keep up with it, and it's wearing me out. Too many interviews and too little time. Not too much else going on this week. Just still working on that solo stuff I told you about, and it's almost all finished being mixed. So let's hope. Fingers crossed it'll be coming to a streaming service near you soon. Let's talk a little bit about our good buddies at Zounds.com. You know and love Zounds.com, the greatest place on the internet to get your music gear, because nobody makes best gear from the best brands more affordable than Zounds.com, and you never have to pay full price because they got great payment plans, and they never charge you interest. And yes, there's no application process. God, that sounded weird. Yes, there's no application. There is no application process at Zounds.com. It's that easy. Zounds.com. Let's get to today's interview. You know, I don't know where on God's green earth Imelda May was when we did this interview, but if you listen closely in the background, you can hear seagulls, I think. I think you can hear seagulls. Listen close. So she must have been somewhere by the sea. Hopefully it was exotic. You know what I like about the second time I interview somebody? Is the second time you don't have to do any of the this is your life stuff. You just get right into whatever's been happening since the last time you interviewed them. And of course, Imelda May always has a lot going on. She just dropped a brand new record that's great. Go listen to it. It's called 11 Past the Hour. She tuned me up on what a clattering means, because I've just lost mine that I've had for a really long time that I bought on Grafton Street, and she told me she was going to help me get a new one. I'm going to hold her to that. Imelda May, if you're listening, I want that clattering. All right, we're going to pick it up talking about poetry and spoken word and how that relates to songwriting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is Imelda May on Walking the Floor.
Yeah, well, I brought out an EP over lockdown. I brought out a spoken word EP called Slip of the Tongue of some of my poetry. And that was really interesting because I came up with a lot of, a few people thought I was mad, thinking that you're crazy. No, who's wanting to listen to spoken word, but I really believed in it, and I write poetry, I'd say more than song, you know, I write poetry daily, and I recorded them, and then one of the days I was supposed to be in recording music, I was with Tim Brann and Davide Rossi, who I worked with a lot on this, and Davide is like a one-man orchestra, he's phenomenal, and I said, you know what, let's not work on music today. I want to put music to it. I'd already recorded the poems, you know, spoken word just, and I wanted to put music to them because I thought it would be the perfect combination. And it was just lovely that matching up some little sound bites that David had worked on for different projects he was working on. He'd do little, you know, snippets of music.
Sure.
And it was really weird because some of the stuff that he had written, where I'd say that would really fit this poem, so let's see if they'll sit well together. And it happened quite a few times that they were exactly the same length. It was spooky. Of
really?
All the, it would end exactly, and sometimes there'd be a change in my in some of the words that I write that say, you know, go into a different change, and then his music would change into, you know, go down into the cellos and take a turn. And then they'd end at the exact same time, and it was a bit weird. So I felt meant to be. Anyway, that kind of took off a little bit for me, and I was really glad on a personal level, but I was also glad that I was right.
it's always good to be right with your label and your manager and your booking agent. Yeah,
always a nice feeling, is it? Smoke, I think you call that.
Is there a difference for you in terms of, I mean, like process or anything, or even like sort of the end result goal between writing poetry and writing songs?
Oh, yeah. I find writing poetry, I suppose it's more, it's freer for me for writing, because I can change the tempo of it, I can change the feel of it. It can be whatever length it wants to be. Songs right. should be like that, but unfortunately they're not. And I don't have to take into consideration, you know, the band or arrangements or playing them live or anything like right. that. I can kind of take and go. And I write about, I suppose, more varied things, topics. But again, I should be doing, you know, that it should be one and the same thing for music. But,
right.
you know, I mean, I don't know. Like, for instance, one of my poems that's done quite well is about it's called GBH.
I saw that and I got excited because I thought it was going to be about the punk rock band.
No, it's a it's about a vibrator.
Oh.
It's called Grievous Battery Harm.
Okay.
And so I don't know why, but for some reason they won't put that on the radio if it's a song.
did you try that as an album track first, and they were like, no. I mean, it's like, is poetry structured similar to songs in like having a hook line and like a chorus and things that you sort of come back to and repeat?
Sometimes sure, but more often than not, no. It can just take it. It can meander, I think, a little, and I like that. And it's very rare that I'll turn a poem into a song, but you know, it's easily doable, because then you'll take. I mean, I always think choruses are like a conversation. You know, when you're talking, there's always a punchline. There's always the point of the conversation is repeated. Especially if you've had a few drinks, you know, it's that a chorus for me is that line that you keep going back to and you keep repeating, because that's the point right. that you're trying to make. So for me, that's what chorus is in a song. And it's easy to if you turn a poem into a song, which I don't often do, but it is easy to find that line that's the point of it. That's the one I want to make and just repeat that.
Did the spoken word album and your new album that's coming out, 11 Past the Hour, were those overlapping projects? Were those like happening at the same time, or were those distinctly? Oh, they were.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm going through the most amazing creativity spurt, and I'm kind of up to that with stuff that I'm doing. I'm just, I can't, it's a little bit manic because I'm just, I'm immersed, you know? I'm writing poetry and songs, you know, sometimes simultaneously. You know, if I get an idea for one while I'm writing the other, I'll maybe put a couple of lines down and keep it on the back burner till later, and then I'll work on the other one later, which is nice.
Does that give you anxiety? That feeling gives me anxiety when I'm juggling like 20 half-baked song ideas. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like until I get them done, I'm in a constant state of just kind of like, oh fuck, I gotta get this shit done.
Yeah. And I have a few, I feel like if I keep them dormant in little pockets in the back of my head, you know? Do you feel
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
I just put them in there, and I know they're there, and I know what they're gonna be, you know, or I know what they're gonna start off as, and I kind of just leave them there for a while, but they're there, and some of them are there years.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, I'll get to that one day. I'll get back to that. But yeah. It's there's a, not an anxiety, but it's not satisfying. It is beautiful when you finish something, but then it's good to keep yourself on your toes. And sometimes it's good creatively anyway, to not be totally satisfied ever.
Right. Yeah, there was a great Noel Gallagher. Why can't I pronounce that? Noel Gallagher quote that I read years ago, and I know he's on your record. Maybe we could talk about that too. But where he said something like, "The recording of a song is just what it sounded like that day."
Yeah, totally. And it's the decisions that you make that day. Yeah. And it's as well as that, it's, you know, when producing it as well, it's like any art, it's like painting a picture. It's almost knowing when to stop.
Right.
And when to back off and leave it be, because you can work on it forever, as you know. And then you listen back to things later on. You know, you listen, if you hear a song that you did ages ago, think, I would never do it like that. What was I thinking?
Right. Well, isn't that the famous story with Start Me Up by the Stones? Like, I think they recorded it like, you know, 50 times or whatever, and went back and listened to the first take, and that's the one that they used. You
know? Yeah. It's often the way, isn't it?
Yeah. Let's talk about the new album a little bit more. Like, I was listening to the title track in particular. A lot of the album does, but the title track really kind of poked out at me as having a very sort of cinematic feel to it. And my first thought was like, what you've been listening to? What have you been vibing off musically?
Well, when I'm writing, I can't listen to anything, or I'll just write that. You're probably really? The same. Yeah. Right. I can't listen to anything or else I'll just write that song and I'll think it's mine. I'll think, I wrote an amazing song the other day. You know?
But I thought that's what we all did, isn't it? I mean, it's like when you steal something, it just comes out like you anyway. Most of the time people don't really know, you know?
So my house gets really quiet when I'm writing. It gets ridiculously quiet. It's quite dull for everybody else. I think that I have to, my battery. Am I going? Am I good? Yeah, my battery's still there. I go quiet. But before that, I was watching a lot of movies and I was going back to classics a lot of the time. So maybe that seeped in there somewhere. But I was going through watching some beautiful old movies and stuff, and then a lot of Alfred Hitchcock and David Lynch and all that. Ooh, so it must go in there, you know. It all seeps in at some point, I suppose.
Well, okay. So speaking of movies, I was watching Ronnie Wood's documentary the other night, and you popped up on screen, and then I saw that you've got not just one, but like a couple songs that he played on, which suggests to me like that's like more than just like getting a hero to come play a guitar solo or something. Like, what's your musical relationship with Mr. Ronnie Wood?
Oh, I love Ronnie dearly. He's family at this point. I love him very, very much. He's I don't know what I'd do without him. Yeah. We met when which you probably saw on that documentary, which everybody should watch that. Somebody Up There Likes Me. That's so much him, and it gives you such a great idea of who he is on that documentary. It's really endearing and lovely and funny, and that's how he is. He's so energetic, and he's like a light bulb that comes into a room, you know. He just lights up the whole room with his enthusiasm and his vibe. But I met Ronnie when I was 16. I've never studied music or anything like that. I went to this little basement club in Brussels, and I was just jamming. It was probably the best education I could have got, was just in these jam sessions. Great musicians from, like, there was the High House Flowers and Van Morrison's band, and all these great musicians that had their night off would be jamming. And it was very free and loose. It went on to like 6 a.m. It was brilliant. And I was this kid in the corner that they used to sneak in, and they kind of adopted me. And I was just, I couldn't get enough of it all. And I remember singing, I was up on stage, I was singing Rolling and Tumbling, and Ronnie Wood jumped up, and he was staying in a hotel nearby at the time, and he jumped up and grabbed a guitar, and we did a couple of tracks together, and it was fabulous, and vibed off each other, and it was definitely a highlight, and I was thrilled at myself, but I remember just really enjoying it, and And that was that. And then I did my own thing and I had my own journey. And I remember I was just so in love with music. I got around that time when I was this teenager, I got offered a couple of record deals, but they were wanting me to be this pop star. And I said, absolutely not. I was horrified. I was just so in love with what I was doing. And then I went off and did that and gigged and worked my ass off and enjoyed every minute of it. And then I ended up going on the road with Jeff Beck, and who was another dearest, dearest friend of mine. And we kind of met, it's a whole other story, but we met because of a crow that I had. I had a pet crow that I rescued. And I'll tell you another day, but I ended up because of this. I can tell you now if you want. But
yeah, sure. Why? It's a podcast. There's no limits. To tell you, your story can go in any direction you want it to.
Okay. So I rescued this crow in a local park of mine. And around that time, I'd just gotten a gig with Jules Holland. And I opened for Jules. And then I went on tour with him. And when I went on tour, I had to bring this baby crow with me, because I was hand feeding them every, couple of hours. He'd fallen out of a tree and hadn't got a feather on him. He was all black and blue and bruised, you know. And I was at this festival, and the crow, Dave, the crow, I had him for a few months, and he became this beautiful big carrion crow who sat on my shoulder and he wouldn't leave me. And he used to fly up I'd put him into a tree on the festivals, and then I'd go and do the gig and come back down, and then he'd fly back to me, and he loved to sit under my leather jacket. He'd go in and keep warm. And I wanted to release him to the wild before it was too late, because he was still young and he was healthy and beautiful. And it was at a Jules Holland gig, and then it was Jeff Beck's wife, Sandra, who rescues crows and animals, came over and she said, "Did I just see you with a crow?" And I said, "Yes." And I showed. I said, "But I'm really trying to get him back, but no rescue centers really want to take crows. They take birds of prey, and I want to. You can't just release them. It doesn't work like that. And I want to release them slowly." But I lived in London at the time, and I thought he needs to be the countryside. And she said, "Well, I have an aviary free, so if you want to come to the house, I'd really love to help you with this." And I said, "Sure." So we went off to Jeff and Sandra's house, and then Jeff and I started jamming around and drinking brandy and sitting up till 3 a.m. singing, and he was playing. And then the crow stayed there and had a beautiful life, and then Jeff asked me to go on tour with him.
Really?
Hmm.
That's amazing. Like, I don't think of, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but I don't think of crows or birds in general as being like snuggly pets that you carry around in your jacket. That's very cool. I mean, I'm curious, like, when you're playing with people like Jeff Beck, and I don't know what that situation was like, or Ronnie Wood, like, presumably those are heroes or people you grew up, with their music. Sometimes, like, working creatively with legends like that can be like, it can be awkward. Like, did you get to a place with either of them or both of them where you could just be kind of like open with your musical opinions
and disagree with them
and say, maybe not that, maybe, you know what I mean? Like, cause that often doesn't happen in those situations.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But you, of course, you always do it respectfully, but you have to have your own vibe. And I suppose you have to, of course they're legends and of course they're brilliant. But I think it's nice to just enjoy the moment with somebody and just thrash it out and love it for what it is. Just have fun with whatever song it is that you're doing and say, "Why don't we try it like this? And God, do you think we should give it a go?" Like, like that. And I suppose I like to have a lot of fun with things, and I don't know. I seem to meet people of the same way, but I don't know. I just get on really well. I get on really well with Jeff, and we had a lot of fun. And we chat and talk about music till all hours of the night, and I'd listen a lot. And anyway, so I ended up going on tour with Jeff, and then with Ronnie, we were at the Classic Rock Awards, and then Jeff said, "I want to introduce you to my pal Ronnie," and I said to Ronnie, "We've met before, but it's a long time ago, and you're not going to remember." And when I told him, he said, "I remember exactly." He said, "Oh my God, you were that kid! You were that kid, like singing blues in this. What the fuck? You were this, you know?" And it was really lovely. And then we kind of picked up where we left off, and we've stayed friends ever since. So that was quite a nice moment. I couldn't believe that he remembered. I never thought it was unusual for a 16-year-old to be singing at 3 a.m. in a blues club, but
that's cool. Like, you know, there was a point a few years ago where we, for whatever reason, Foo Fighters and Jeff Beck crossed paths at a few different things, and I tried desperately to have a conversation with him, and he was not interested at all. But now I know. Next time I'm bringing a parakeet with me in my pocket. Like, hey, look, check that out. Look what I got.
Oh, I love Jeff and Sandra so much that I run down to them when I need to hide, and they take care of me. When I need to run away from the world, I run down to Jeff and Sandra.
And he's obviously him, and I'm sure Ronnie Wood both are big rockabilly fans. And I know you have some rockabilly in you know, you've obviously made a lot of rockabilly music. And did you guys connect on that? Like, were you guys like listening to like Johnny Burnett records and stuff?
Oh yeah. And Ronnie's mad into Chuck Berry, and that's what I worked on with Ronnie. It was his Chuck Berry tribute album. He said that he always wanted to do it. And he said, "Do you want to do it?" And I said, "Yes." And I loved Chuck Berry. I'm a bigger fan of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. So we'd sit and talk about, obviously in my mind, she totally must have influenced him. But I can't believe that she wasn't a big influence on him, to be honest.
Well, maybe indirectly.
Maybe indirectly, I don't know. I got to open up for Chuck Berry once in New York, really? In B.B. King's club, and I wanted to ask him that, but I never got the chance. But I got to chat with him for a little while, but he was more interested in being flirtatious than talking about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Why does that not surprise me?
Well, yeah. You know, not in a bad way. He was cool as fuck, to be honest with you. And I just followed his lead on it. And at one point, he actually, I remember during the gig, I went out front then to watch him, and he was playing away, and then he left the stage. And he was gone for quite a while. And he just went into his room and closed the door and continued to play. And everybody out front could hear him. And he was brilliant. But he was gone into his room. Don't know whether he went to the bathroom. I don't know whether he went for a drink. I don't know. And he disappeared and then just came back out on stage. And everybody cheered. It was a really good moment.
You know, I saw Chuck Berry a couple times, and I always thought it was such a shame. And you see this a lot with artists of that era that continued to work. I always thought it was such a shame that he didn't just have a really shit hot band that he kept together all the time. Cause famously, you know, and a lot of people do this, like he would just hire a band in kind of every town. And so it was always real hit or miss. And I mean, I saw one show that was pretty good, and I saw one show that was really bad, but it just always made me sad. Like, God, man, this dude's a legend. Like one of the most important dudes in music history ever. And could just put together like a band of ringers that was just amazing every night and chooses.
Oh, I can't even tell you sometimes the disappointment that you have in that. And I mean, I've seen bands, I'm sure you have, open for these legends, and you can tell that they don't know the fucking songs. Sorry, right. I don't know if we're in your podcast.
Oh, you can cuss.
But it does make me very angry, because you think, Jesus, learn the songs. If you're going to play Berry, learn the songs. I can't tell you how much that used to really upset me. And it was infuriating. It's like, I don't know if you ever saw, I'm sure you did, that Johnny Cash documentary, and he was working with different bands along the way like that, and they'd be
just to see
these icons and really important people in the history of music to be in that situation was, I always thought was, you know, immoral almost. It just felt so.
It always felt like they're sort of disregarding their own legacy. And I'm sure, you know, different people have different reasons for whatever choices they make and that I'm not privy to. But yeah, it just always felt like, God, this could be so much better. And you're just too important for this. Yeah. Do you think you'll ever dip your toe back into the rockabilly world? Or do you still, you know?
No, I won't. No, I don't think so. I think I came to, it got kind of, it was part of, I suppose, part of my musical, I hate saying the word journey, but it was part of my developing or learning and involvement. And one of the reasons that I got so into it was that I remember people saying to me, you'd do really well if you only got rid of that. And it really got on my nerves because I thought, why is it getting such a bad rap if it was so instrumental? You know, because the reason I started listening to rockabilly is when I said, because I was mad into the Ramones, the Cramps, and, you know, when you'd listen to what they're doing, they were doing covers of all these old songs and Johnny Burnett songs, and I was thinking, what? And then you'd hear interviews with the Beatles when they went on tour with Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent. They were trying to get their autographs, and of course Jeff and Robert Plant, all these people talk about it. And I thought, I'm gonna do that. And obviously the Stray Cats did it brilliantly, and and obviously Wanda Jackson is the most amazing female rockabilly singer, and Janis Martin and all that. But I thought, I want to do this now. I want to really go there, because everyone told me not to. And it wasn't because it wasn't in spite of anybody. It was just, I felt like it was really hard done by as a musical genre. I couldn't understand it. So I went for it. But then it kind of became a bit of a, I felt like I was bound by it after a while, you know. It was, you know, if I went out of that, I don't know whether I did that to myself, but I couldn't go any further with it after a while. I hit a glass ceiling, writing wise anyway, with it. And I thought, I'm done. So, you know, I felt such a huge, I kind of continued back on the journey I was on before getting stuck in one place for a while, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I was able to just move on to where I was going, and to not know where that was is really lovely. If to not know where I'm going for me is what floats my boat. You know, I like not around the corner, and that excites more than that. A little bit of fear is always good. A little bit of the unknown is always good for me. Anyway, adventure.
Yeah. Well, on that tip, your album's coming out on the 23rd, and, you know, we're not quite out of this COVID business yet, and touring hasn't really come back yet. Although I don't know what the state of that is overseas exactly, but what are your plans for getting out on the road? I assume you must have, like all the rest of us, you must have like plans ready to go, and you're just kind of waiting to get the green light.
Well, the album's been moved to the 16th, I think. Well, COVID put it all back. Because I was doing, it was coming out and coinciding with a tour and all this, and then the tour be cancelled, and then another tour. And I just thought, just let's get this out. I can't be holding it close to my chest any longer. I need to just get it out. And I think I'm starting a tour. I'm doing a couple of gigs, but I'm starting a tour next April. So it's really weird to release an album April 1 year and have a tour April the next year. I don't know how that's going to work, but I'll get along and do it. What about you?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, like, cause we, same deal, you know, we had a big year planned for last year, lots of touring and all that sort of thing. And it all got postponed or canceled. And then the album just kept getting pushed further and further back. And we finally put it out not too long ago. But then it was sort of like, it seemed like, I was hearing like, oh, it's going to be maybe 2022 is when touring is going to come back. And then that kind of moved to like this fall. And then it seems like fairly optimistic that in the summer we'll be doing, I don't know. You know, it's just, it seems like it's getting, the projections are getting a little rosier. It seems like every week, yeah. You know,
we'll get there. We'll yeah. get there. But yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait to go and see you live again.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll be back at it as soon as they let us, for sure.
I went to see you in the last time you played in, was it Wembley or was it the O2? It was in London.
Oh, around our last record?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I did not know you were there. You should have come, because that would have been after I interviewed you, right? You should have come back and drank some free beer.
I would love that. I was all mental in my silver boots, jumping around the place like mad. I had best time. Obviously, the best. No, I get too shy sometimes to do that. I just sneak in, sneak out.
All right. No, I do. I totally get that. When I go to somebody else's show, the last thing on earth I want to do is bother them backstage. I'm like, I know they don't want to talk to me. They want to like relax and get ready to play the show, and then they want to split and go take a shower. They don't want me hanging out back there small talking with them.
I know. Hi, hello.
Hey, entertain me.
I just went gig and really, really enjoyed myself. I thought it was I loved it.
Yeah, hopefully we cross paths at a festival or whatever. Hey, there was something I wanted to ask you about because I was looking at your promo photos in your press pack. And mm-hmm. there was one that looked all, you know, Peaky Blinders, like in front of a gypsy caravan kind of setup. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, because, you know, most of the people I think that listen to my podcast are American and probably don't know about, and I don't really know about that Irish gypsy culture thing. What is the history with that? Is that related to like European gypsies? Is it ethnically connected or what is the sort of history lineage of it?
It's two different things. That's a caravan that I bought off an Irish traveller. So in Ireland, there's the Irish travellers. It's quite a difficult one at the moment because I got into quite a lot of trouble for that because some of the traveller community, some totally applauded me for it and some were cross at me for having the photo.
I didn't know that. Maybe you had, if you were related to, you know,
well, no, this travelers, thing, what? The reason I have that caravan is I bought it off an Irish traveler, but my grandmother, she was a very quiet woman, my father's mother. And she always said that, that her great grandmother was a gypsy. And so it gave me a curiosity and interest, but she was Romani gypsy. So Romani gypsy is European. So it'd be, they'd move around France and Spain and all that there. And all my family are the kind of same coloring as me. So it kind of, it gave me an interest in Romani gypsies, but the Irish travelers are a different group of people. But it's quite tough at the moment because, especially around there's my battery telling me, especially around Black Lives Matter protests and people fighting for equality and addressing the horrendous racism that's going on at the moment. That's been going on all over the world wonderfully. I'm so glad people are having those conversations, honestly, at last. But the Irish travellers, that conversation is not moving as quick as it should do in Ireland, for sure, and it needs to be addressed. So I wrote this poem a little while ago called You Don't Get to Be Racist in Irish. And there was this a guy called me, he was from this Equality Funds, and so they were basically, the end of the day is I gave them my poem and said, use it, do what you want with it, have it. And they're after getting £3 million towards a fund to try and start up and help this conversation with minorities within Ireland, and one of those are the Irish Travellers. So I'm hoping to get involved and do some work to do what I can. And the beginning of that process was the photograph of me in my gypsy caravan. And then because of the conversations that I had with a few of the Irish Traveller community in addressing that problem. So I'm starting another little journey on that, and I'll see where it ends up.
Well, that reminds me, I wanted to ask you about the song Made to Love that I know you had, and I'm not familiar with these two women, an author and an activist, Gina Martin, and I'm going to screw this name up, Dr. Shola Moshagbamimu.
I'm sure
that I just messed that up, but and I know you had them come sing on your track. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I'm big fans of them both. I met them at International Women's Day that was hosted by Annie Lennox in London a couple of years ago. And I think she'd invited them on to speak, and it was just a beautiful day, full of men and women, by the way, which is the way it should be. And it was just such a positive day, and it was full of wonderful speakers, and I was learning a lot, you know, and I was jumping up on my feet a lot, and it was a lot of common sense that I just found it such an inspiring day, you know. And I totally believe in moving towards equality for sure. Actually, I was talking to somebody a little while ago. Somebody was interviewing and asking me about it, and wasn't so thrilled. He wasn't too hot on it, and I noticed he had a wall full of photographs behind him. And I said, "You see all those photographs behind you?" And I said, "Would that represent your family if you just took all the women out of those photographs and it was just all the men?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, that's the same within speech and within art and within literature and within music. It's only seeing half of the picture. And you literally said you wouldn't like to see half of the picture of your family. So it's a nice balance to have all of us together. It makes the family." So go ahead.
I watched you perform it on the Graham Norton show, and I was wondering if those were those two women? Were those the two women that were performing? So are they actually sing?
Well, I asked them to sing. So I wanted them. So Made to Love is about fighting for love. It's a song about if we love, then we are love. So I wrote it from the perspective of love as a living being.
Like love and personified as a person?
Yes. Right. Yes. And from person to person. I am love. I am, you know, I'm the middle of it. I'm Martin Luther, Lenin, Buddha, I'm Mary Ellie, Frank, I'm Jupiter, I'm every person that you meet, I'm every bum on every street, I'm gay, I'm straight, bi, I'm trans, you know. And it was, I was quite brisk with just saying it as it was, because I just wanted to punch it out there, you know, really simplify it, because I wanted to just say, it's us, it's every person that you meet, it's every human, it's me, it's you. I was feeling very inspired that it's us and it's in us. And I love these two women, and I asked them if they'd join me. And I said, let's go for it. And they both were able to sing beautifully. And we just had the best, most positive day. And the two, I wanted their voices on that song, because they lend their voices in that way all the time for our benefit. And you can't even imagine, you know, the shit that they get for that on a daily basis, that they take for our benefit. We reap the benefits of all that they do, and all the grief that they get for us. It's just, it blows my mind what they do, you know, and how they cope with that mentally. I don't know how they deal with it, but they keep fighting on. And so I really wanted them on that, because it meant a lot to me, and it just felt so good. And having them on the Graham Norton show, I felt like we were fighting together, and it was and show Dr. Shola is just the voice of reason in every argument that you hear. She just strides on in and makes more sense than anyone I've ever heard. And Gina Martin began her activism from a guy upskirted her at a festival. He stuck a camera between her legs and took a photograph of her skirt. She wrestled him to the ground, grabbed the camera off him, ran to the security guy with this guy hot on her heels, And it ended up, the guy said, I'm really sorry, but he's done nothing. It's not against the law. And he handed the fella back his camera. And she thought, well, do you know what? I'm going to change the law. And she did. She worked her ass off, and she hired her lawyers and campaigned and went into parliament, and she actually changed the law that it's now illegal. Really? So I thought, yeah, I just thought, what a woman. And she was only in her 20s when she did that. You're just thinking, oh, wow. Well,
with any artist that gets involved in anything remotely political, I imagine you must get the flood of shut up and play commentary.
Yes, all the time.
Right.
Shut up and play. So which do you want me to do? Do you want me to shut up or play?
I don't know. I don't live overseas, but I feel like politics and art and music. I mean, not like we don't have our own history of that here, but I feel like there's more of a shut the fuck up and play sentiment in America maybe than there is in the UK and Ireland, you know. Or I don't know, maybe it's just my taste in British music has always leaned to, you know, the Clash or whatever that fuses those things together, Billy Bragg, people like that.
Well, I'm opinionated. I'm a strong, fiery Irish woman. I have a lot to say, and I'll say it, and I'll say it within my music. You know, it's just I write about what I want to write about. I write about what I feel strongly about. And you know, that's my place to do it. You know, if I want to write, I will. But ultimately, I write about love. I just don't want to write about always romantic love. But it's really all about love at the end of the day. I've a massively open heart. It gets wounded regularly. But I do think I don't think love is the easy option most of the time, but I do think it's worth fighting for. It's certainly right, worth singing and writing about. And that's all that really interests me, is trying to love as much as I can. I'm not preaching to anyone. You know, if you don't like what I'm saying, you don't have to listen to me. I'm not making you. I'm not a politician. I'm not preaching. I'm just writing what's important to me. And it's as simple as that, you know. But I am Irish, and I am female, and I'm from a line of strong women. So that goes with its own territory, I suppose. It's just the way.
Last question, and I probably asked you some version of this last time I interviewed you, and I feel like I ask everybody Irish that I come into contact with some version of this question. And be honest, does it bother the Irish generally that all of us Americans think we're Irish?
No, not at all.
We all claim it. We all claim it.
I think I wouldn't worry about it, because the Irish, you know, we love to claim anybody that's a joke. You know, such and such, whatever president comes into any country, you go, they're Irish. They're great granny on their father's side, Irish.
Yeah, absolutely.
We like to claim all the good ones.
Yeah. Well, good. No. That's reassuring. Oh. That makes me feel a little better when I, you know. Well, my dad's side's been here in this country since before time began. So I think that he's that side of the lineage is just commingled with everything. God only knows. But on my mom's side, I mean, it's like, it's so cliche. Came over in like the middle of the famine and, you know, settled in New Jersey, working in a hat factory and, you know, all that sort of classic tale. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. We can talk about that more. I want to know more about that.
Well, I'll tell you a quick funny story. So years ago, probably 20 years ago or so, when I first joined Foo Fighters, we were in Dublin. I was walking around on Grafton Street. I went to one of those little jewelry kiosks and I bought a clatter ring, right? And I felt like, yeah, this is cool. You know, I got my clatter ring, my fucking heritage. And I wore that thing forever and, you know, had kids. And eventually, just a couple of years ago, I was heading over. I was going to do a show in Dublin. And I told my kids, I was like, I'm going to buy you guys clatter rings when I'm there, you know. It's like just like mine. And so I go there and I go find some little kiosk on Grafton Street, and as I'm trying to pick out rings for my kids, the guy there just kind of like, he looks at my hand and goes, I could fit you for a men's ring. which I thought was his, you know, not so subtle dig. But and then I just lost it. It just disappeared. I took it off and put it on my countertop, and I think it went down the sink, or my cat ate it, or I don't know what happened to it. So I need a new clatterring next time I go. So I'm going to hit you up for the. Oh, good. There you go. Thank you.
You know what it means? It means love, friendship, and loyalty.
The heart isn't it? Don't you wear it one way if you're in a relationship? Yes. The
heart is for love, the hands are for friendship, and the crown is for loyalty. And okay. You wear it facing outwards if you haven't got a love, and you wear it facing towards the heart, facing towards your heart if your heart is taken by is love with someone else. But it was the old Irish wedding ring. That's what we used as the wedding.
Okay. Good to know. Well, thank you for the tuning me up a little bit on my Irish history. And it was, as always, a pleasure talking to you, and appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, but I want to hear more of your side, because I'm sick of talking about myself.
Well, start a podcast and have me on. It's a deal.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
There you go. I'm in. Awesome. Take care of yourself. Okay. Yeah, fun signing those records.
Yahoo, that was Imelda May on Walking the Floor. Make sure you go check out her brand new record, 11 Past the Hour. Give it a spin. I want that clatter ring. I'm going to hold you to it. I swear to God. That's it for this week, kids. We will be back, as always, next week with something great. Who will it be? Will it be Jay Bentley from Bad Religion? It very likely will be, because I got to get that one posted. So we'll see you then. Adios, amigos!